The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Ask an Atheist, where our beliefs are guided by evidence, not faith. I'm Becky Friedman, and today with me are Mike Gillis. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing pretty good.
And Case, how are you?
Well, a little cranky. My favorite radio station is playing gospel this morning, but otherwise I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay,
all right. We're not your favorite radio station?
Well, when you're on, you are, yeah.
So usually on Ask an Atheist, we are a call-in show, and so we do accept calls at 253-584-1480. Usually when we get started with our program, we talk about something that we're counting down to. Mike, tell us about what we're counting down to.
Oh, okay. If you're somebody who's been listening to our show for any amount of time, you know about the countdown to backpedaling. This is a response to a fundamentalist Christian group based out of California called Family Radio. Family Radio has been putting up billboards, not just around the country, but in other countries as well. I know as far as like Puerto Rico, but it goes beyond that. There's some in Russia, Greenland, Australia. They're all over the place, proclaiming that on May 21st, Jesus is going to return like a superhero, wave his magic wand, and kick off the end times.
Now, Mike, that's only 61 days between now and then.
Yeah, we're really getting close. And what we're counting down to is not actually May 21st, but May 22nd. That's going to be the day where we get to hear how these guys are going to respond when the world just keeps on spinning. And I know that one thing we put up something on our blog recently, actually asking folks, please, if you see one of these things, think of this as like a crazy Amber Alert. If you see one of these crazy billboards, please let us know immediately. Take a picture. We will put it on our website at askanatheist.tv.
Yeah, send that in.
Yeah, we actually had a caller, I believe last week or the week before, who called in and asked us and said, you know what, I hear you guys talk about this every single week. I hear it's just like, I'm getting so tired of it, but then I saw one.
Ryan, also one of our listeners, emailed us from BC, and he reports that he's seen them. So if you've seen them in your location, let us know by snapping a photo of you in front of one of those car wraps or in front of one of those billboards and send it to us at askanatheist.tv.
Yeah, there's a big red button in front of the site. Just click it. Let us put it on like Photo Bucket or something and send us a link to that photo. We want to see these things.
Now, one of our listeners actually contacted us through their website asking, Dear Ask an Atheist, I don't think I've heard anyone state the obvious about countdown to backpedaling. And I was really anxious to know what was so obvious that we were missing. But he says, when the day passes and the we can know people are confronted, they say that, or they will say, rather, that it was put there, I think their campaign he's referring to cause people to think about religion and think about the Bible. They will say they really were never very serious about the end of the world, just that they felt it was a clever way to get publicity. And this comes from a listener or viewer, Jim, and he likes to call it lying for Jesus.
Well, it is lying for Jesus. I find it kind of funny that they expected they'd get a positive response to this. Like, hey, guess what? We're liars.
Yeah. I love how everything is God's plan, too, whether or not it's truth or lying, you know?
So God's just a troll, then?
Yeah.
Going for a sort of an Andy Kaufman thing every so often. He wants to get you ready in the mood to die and then go, hey, just kidding.
Just kidding.
Just like the Isaac and Abraham story.
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? You don't have to die.
But thanks for believing me. I appreciate it. You know?
Yeah.
Now collect your prizes.
So we'll see if we get any more reports on that. And check out our website also at askanatheist.tv, where one of our producers, Beth, has written a blog entry about we can know and we can't know. So usually we next go into news. Case, you've picked out some news stories that talk about some vaccines and disease resurgence and how that's been covered in popular media.
Yeah, I thought this would be an interesting topic, especially given what we're going to talk about today. Give us some background about our topic today, which
is
going
to be... And Case, what is our topic today?
Our topic today is the anti-vaxxer crowd and why they've been so prolific and the damage that they've done in pushing their pseudoscientific viewpoint that vaccines have a link to autism.
But Case...
Yes?
They said this on Oprah, and Oprah's right about everything.
You're right. But okay, let's move on to that news report. So anyway, this is from NPR. They're from their health blog. California whooping cough cases near 55-year high. The sad story of the whooping cough epidemic is that it's hit California this year, keeps getting sadder. The state health department now says there have been 9 deaths, all babies. All the infants were 2 months or younger when they got sick. Overall, over 4,000 cases of whooping cough or pertussis have been reported this year. That's the most since nearly 5,000 cases were reported in 1955, this was in September when this was written, and the year is far from over. Let's see. Among these cases, the public health authorities have led to hospitalization. Nearly 3/4 involved children less than 6 months old, and of those kids, 77% were Hispanic.
Now, can you tell us if there's an infant that's younger than 6 months, are they too young to be immunized against pertussis?
Let's see. Well, kids usually get their first shot against whooping cough at about 2 months. So, but the 3 shots, they're usually done within 6 months to fully assure that the child's immunity system can fight off the bacteria that causes pertussis. Really what comes into play here is herd immunity for the most part, and that is having enough children and adults immunized against pertussis in such a way that it protects the more vulnerable, either the ones that can't get immunized for the fact that they're too old or too young or their immunity is compromised in some other way.
And so that would really mean that there isn't the actual virus circulating in the population such that these infants would contract this very dangerous and very serious disease. Is that the idea behind herd immunity?
Exactly, yeah. When you have enough people who've been immunized, it helps protect those who can't be immunized. I think the bottom part of the article I actually found the most interesting. Earlier this month, Canada advised travelers to California to make sure that their whooping cough vaccinations were up to date before making the trip. That's right. Another country has said that if when you come to California, make sure that you have your vaccinations up to date. And that's really telling. We're almost like a third world country in that way. Well, at least California.
But in that sense, the anti-vax movement has been most successful in California?
Yeah, California has what's known as an opt-out for vaccinations, which says that if you have a reason why you feel that you don't want your child to be vaccinated, you can just opt out of the program and not be vaccinated at all.
Does the state of California take a stance on this? Do they say that we would prefer that you were, or do they take some sort of cowardly neutral stance on vaccination?
I think they go the cowardly neutral stance on that one. Yeah. So anyway, that's one of the news reports we had. And I know you had another one for us, Mike.
Yeah, this was from Bloomberg Health News. Measles outbreak triggered by unvaccinated child. Case illustrates that people who choose not to vaccinate put others at risk, researcher says. What began as a family trip to Switzerland in 2008 ended up as a public health nightmare in California. The family's 7-year-old boy, who was intentionally unvaccinated against measles, was exposed to the virus while traveling in Europe. When he returned home to San Diego, he unknowingly exposed a total of 839 people, and an additional 11 unvaccinated children contracted the disease. 3 of those infected were babies too young to yet have received the measles vaccines, and one of these babies was hospitalized for 3 days with 106-degree fever.
So that baby then, Mike, would be an example of one of those individuals who is protected by herd immunity.
Absolutely, and that when you choose not to vaccinate your child, you're not just making that decision for your child, you're potentially making health decisions for other people's children as well.
Wow. Is there anything more that the article says?
Yeah, there was a rep from the CDC who said, this study serves as a reminder that measles can be a very serious disease. It can lead to severe complications and death, and that the measles, mumps, and rubella, that's the MMR vaccine, is highly effective and the best way to prevent measles. It's also a reminder that people who choose not to vaccinate don't just put themselves and their own children at risk, but like I said, also their communities, and including a lot of infants who are too young to be immunized.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, where we're going with this is that these are diseases that have long been considered defeated by modern science. With the whooping cough outbreaks that are at a 55-year high, we have measles being the leading cause of vaccine-preventable deaths among young children. And then here in the U.S., we had our first polio outbreak in 26 years not long ago. So
And that was one incidence of one individual with polio in the United States, if I'm correct, if I'm thinking of the right case?
Yeah, the one that affected the Amish community?
Yes.
Yes, yes. So,
is the Amish community a community that vaccinates? Or, I mean, I know that they do take certain stances on not using certain technologies.
Right. I think electricity, obviously they're against electricity, but I don't know what their vaccine.
Because I know even from the sort of era that they're kind of recreating, there were some versions of vaccines even back then. I know that Benjamin Franklin actually lost a child that he had refused to vaccinate against smallpox. Of course, certainly you didn't have things like syringes or anything back then. I know they just used a knife, and it was a very, very crude way of vaccinating people. But even back then, they understood the principles of vaccinating somebody against a disease. And Benjamin Franklin actually lost his son because he refused to vaccinate.
Oh, wow. Okay. Did not know that.
Well, if you, our listeners, know about the Amish community or about have anything to ask us about vaccination or non-vaccination, feel free to give us a call at 253-584-1480.
Okay. So, well, vaccines have been out for these diseases for decades now. They're considered to be one of the greatest triumphs of modern medicine. They prevent some 16 kinds of diseases, increasing our lifespan of our population by some 30 years. So they are known quantity, so to speak. And so why aren't people vaccinating anymore? And that's the issue we thought we'd tackle today is what's going on with parents and vaccines. And it can pretty much be traced to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who is a doctor at the Royal Free Hospital in England. And he published an article in The Lancet in 1998. And that article put forth a hypothesis that there was a link between autism and the MMR vaccine. In a nutshell, the MMR vaccine is a vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. It's three vaccinations in one. And what Andrew Wakefield had said was that these three vaccines taken together they get lodged in the intestines. They cause the proteins get lodged in the intestines. They cause a toxin to leach into the body, and this affects brain development. That was his theory. So parents all over the UK took this message parents who had autistic children took this message to heart. They finally felt like they had someone to speak for them. So in the years that followed, Wakefield's research was not reproducible. They also found they had a conflict of interest. They found that the children that he used for the study were referred to him by attorneys that were looking to sue the vaccine makers. And then we also uncovered the fact that Andrew Wakefield had a patent that he filed a few months just before his Lancet article, which he was trying to make his own vaccine and trying to profit from that.
So even without the obvious financial incentive of creating his own vaccine, you have a question of somebody skewing a sample on a bit of scientific research, that if, like, for instance, I'm trying to create a link or discover if there a link exists between, say, people living near a power plant or near a freeway or something, and lung disease or cancer or whatever, and then I inject into my study a bunch of people who are already suing or looking to sue the thing I'm investigating, I'm already skewing it by injecting people who have that disease rather than taking a random sample.
Right. Not only do you have multiple lines of conflict of interest, both financially, but also when he starts to use a sampling that is not random, that's chosen, that's pre-chosen, then you definitely have a distortion of science. And this was clearly for gain of some kind, either prestige, money, who knows. So anyway, it wasn't long before the Sunday Times investigative reporter Brian Deer, he had actually picked up on this, and he's actually the one responsible for us uncovering a lot of these facts about Andrew Wakefield. So they had a big expose about him, and within 11 months, Andrew Wakefield left the UK and came to the US. And when he came to the US, his story changed a little bit, and that was, it wasn't necessarily these three vaccines put together. It was an ingredient in one of the vaccines called thimerosal that was causing autism.
So, Case, if he had an original hypothesis or an original claim that he then wanted to test in the UK, and it turned out that this study was not legit due to the conflict of interest that you guys have spoken about, and about the sampling sizes and the actual sample being skewed, do you think that this was... do you think that Wakefield would have been able to come to the U.S. and test a new claim or a new hypothesis? It seems to me like this would be a great opportunity to test a new one, Is that what resulted?
Well, no, that's not the path he took. What he did was he set up an organization called Open House in Texas. And what he did was he took in children, and he claimed that he would diagnose, treat, and in some cases cure children with autism.
Are you saying that he claims that he has a cure for autism?
Yes, and we'll get to that in a minute. What I thought would be great though is if we for some of our listeners, if we just at least cover what autism is. Autism is a spectrum brain disorder that impairs social function and communication, and autistic children often suffer from repetitive and restrictive behavior. And so for parents of these children, it's a very difficult disease to live with in that disorder, I should say, to live with in that the children are very hard to raise. They don't make eye contact. They don't follow social cues, and they could be very, very difficult to raise.
Is autism a relatively new disorder or phenomenon that we've seen, or has this been around for a while?
It's been around for a while. One of the things that people find striking is that in 1980, there was only 1 in 5,000 children was considered autistic. I think the current sampling in 2010 was 1 in 110 children are considered autistic. So this has caused alarm, understandably, among many parents who are looking for an answer as to why this is.
And I can imagine that they'd look very hopeful upon somebody who claims not only that he has a specific cause that completely takes it out of their hands and gives them somebody to blame for this, but also gives them that hope for a cure, whether there's any evidence behind it or not.
Right. A lot of parents feel like, you know, a guy like Andrew Wakefield, who has rock star status among parents with autistic children, many of them feel that he's like the lone voice who's speaking up for people who don't have a voice. And unfortunately, he's turned out to be not much more than a huckster.
Yeah, that's really sad.
Yeah.
Well, if you have, our listeners, if you have any experience with autism or raising autistic children, any experience with any kind of, vaccines or debates in your family about whether to vaccinate or not, please do call us at Ask an Atheist at 253-584-1480.
So one of the things I definitely wanted to touch on, the fact was that this is a very emotional issue. And I've seen a few television specials. I've seen some websites about this. And many parents who have autistic children they're angry, they're sad, they feel vulnerable, and they want someone or something to blame. And that's why Wakefield and the anti-vax message is so seductive. It's because not only does it claim to have a simplistic answer for or a simplistic reason for autism, but maybe they have a cure. And so they come across as standing up for little people. But the truth is, and we're going to cover that, is that they're profiting from the tragedy of others with little or no scientific backing for their claim.
And we'll be back after our break, after a word from some of our sponsors, where we'll talk a little bit more about this emotional resonance with parents, about evidence regarding vaccines and vaccination, and about evidence-based medicine and things like that. We'll talk a little bit more about Andrew Wakefield. Again, please give us a call at 253-584-1480. Hot button topic at Ask an Atheist. We're looking for anti-vaxxers.
If you're an atheist or atheist-friendly person and you'd like to join the Ask an Atheist crew after the show for conversation, beer, hot dogs, and brats, it's happening at 5 o'clock at the Red Hot.
The Red Hot specializes in craft beers and delicious hot dogs and brats.
On tap right now, Walking Man Homo Erectus Imperial IPA, Great Divide Titan IPA, Georgetown Lucille IPA, Sierra Nevada Pale, Alpine Pilsner, Anchor Porter, Stone Green Flash Port Brewing Highway 78 Scotch Ale, Walking Man Black Cherry Stout, Sound Brewing Beverager, New Belgium Le Terroir, Old Tacoma Lager, Schooner Extract 3 Grid IPA on cask, and North Coast Old Rasputin Russian Imperial Stout on Nitro.
Join us at the Red Hot, 2914 6th Avenue in Tacoma.
This is a 21 and over establishment.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an integral part of your business. But that's not all. We can set you up with VoIP, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to helping your business succeed through and with technology. At Tacoma Telematics, we are committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Hi, welcome back to Ask an Atheist, where we're accepting calls at 253-584-1480. I'm Becky, and today I've got Mike and Case with me. We're talking about the controversy surrounding vaccinations and vaccinating your children. We were just talking about how autism is one of the most really emotionally wrenching things that a parent can experience in their family, and how many of these individuals who are raising autistic children are looking for some kind of cause. Case, what was the cause that a lot of these parents were looking towards?
Well, you know, a lot of the children. It's important to note that the first signs of autism are usually seen at about the 15th month mark. Not making eye contact and not speaking and making the repetitive behaviors, and this is about the same time that vaccinations are given. So a lot of parents will take this as a correlation. But correlation does not always mean causation. One thing I want to toss out to you guys was the notion of anecdotal evidence and why it's not scientific. And Mike and I, you had talked about this earlier. Tell me, or tell them, why anecdotal evidence is not considered scientific.
Well, for one, people really do have a tendency to get these things wrong. It's a recognition. One of the things that science does really well is it recognizes that people have biases and that people in our senses can be fooled. We can experience something and be dead wrong about it even though we saw it. And over time, of course, our memory of this event is going to be there. The nice thing about science is not only is it something that has to be repeatable and independently verifiable, but it has to be something that we can actually measure and reproduce. And we were talking about that in terms of things like, say, cryptozoology, where the best evidence that these guys can produce, which oftentimes is exposed as a fraudulent or a hoax of some kind, is eyewitness as testimony. And it's usually incredibly vague, whether it's you spotted Bigfoot or you spotted a UFO. And often you can also get contradictory accounts, even from two people who saw the same thing. So one of the really important things to do in science is not only can we witness or invoke this thing to happen in a controlled environment, but also that we recognize that our own senses can be. And that's the thing about things like, say, peer review, that even Andrew Wakefield writing something like this, he has to kind of run the gamut. He's got to run the gauntlet of all these other scientists saying, okay, let's actually look at the research. Did you cross your T's? Did you dot your I's? Did you do due diligence?
Right.
Now, surely, Mike, we wouldn't want to invoke the kind of conditions in a controlled environment where we try and actually invoke autism in children. That would just be unethical and tragic. So how would you have a study that would sort of look at the development of autism and try and look at correlations and even causal links?
Well, I think you'd have to find children that are already diagnosed or at least exhibit the symptoms of being autistic. And take them from a certain sample size. Do you find that there's anything that these children have in common? Is there anything that they've been exposed to? Are they living in a certain area? Is there something you connect to some sort of socioeconomic situation?
Isn't this just what Andrew Wakefield did, though? That's what many people have said.
Yeah, but he did it with a remarkably small sample size. One of the things I love that P.Z. Myers, who's an atheist blogger, does is he points out how a lot of online polls are eventually bunk. That essentially, if I put a... if we put a poll on the Ask an Atheist website that said, does God exist? And then we asked our listeners and our fans, many of whom are atheists, to vote on that, you're not going to get a
representative sample of the population.
No, it's the same way that if I was I ran a political party and I said, who are you voting for president? And I put that poll on that party's website, it's going to be horribly skewed by the people I choose. Andrew Wakefield not only chose an incredibly small sample of people, but he also chose a number of them were already biased, people that were actually looking already to make that link. And I actually did work at a market research place doing phone surveys, years ago, and there's a lot of painstaking work that goes into making sure you hit your quotas. Like if, for instance, this percentage of the population is Caucasian or African American, this percentage of the population is male, is female, you want the survey size, even if it's something like a few hundred or a thousand, you want that to represent the population as a whole as closely as possible so that the sample size isn't just taken from one area. Like if I just do one neighborhood or one church or one room of people, it's not going to work. It's like, what is the median income of a group of people who are in Congress? It's a much higher than a group of people who live in a trailer park. So you can't use this very specific group to make a generalization about all of the population.
You know, that's why I like the study that Denmark had done. They have a national health registry, which is really robust. It's and what they did was they track the life in Denmark. They track your life, your health, how long you've lived, where you've lived, what you died of, and that sort of thing, throughout the entirety of your life, if you're a citizen of Denmark. And what they did was...
So you're saying the sample size is an entire country.
Yeah, yeah, which is very nice. And what they did was they analyzed the data on children with autism and compared it. And what they did was they found that children, they found no difference in autism between vaccinated and non-vaccinated children.
So no difference in the rate of autistic children between those who were vaccinated and those who were not vaccinated?
That's correct.
And you would expect some sort of a correlation between the non-vaccination and a drop in autism.
Exactly. They also repeated this study in Japan and the U.S., and in the UK, and they all had the same findings. There was no causal relationship found between vaccination and autism. These are very, very authoritative, peer-reviewed studies, and that they completely shut down the whole notion of vaccinations causing autism.
And now, is this Andrew Wakefield's original hypothesis, that it was all three, measles, mumps, and rubella, German measles, vaccine combined into one that had no link to autism? Or was it that there was no link to an increase in autism for vaccines that carried the preservative thimerosal? Or was it over a whole period of time?
Oh, well, the Lancet article, that was with regards to the MMR vaccine specifically. When that was exposed by the Sunday Times, when it came to the U.S., it changed to thimerosal. And thimerosal has been primarily, ingredients in vaccines in general, has been primarily the hypothesis put forward by anti-vax groups such as Generation Rescue, Autism Speaks, Jenny McCarthy, and Andrew Wakefield. So the
original hypothesis was that it was the close succession of these viruses all sort of thrown into one where he would rather stagger them. And now he's completely changing his reason but keeping his conclusion and saying that, no, it's in fact this preservative. But as you said, that preservative was taken out. Has he changed his tune?
Yes, yes. The tune has changed from mercury to aluminum to other ingredients. I haven't kept track of actually what Wakefield is saying right now, but he still promotes a link between the two.
Well, we do have a caller on the line, Bill from Olympia. Bill, it says here that you took care of your grandson who developed autism. Bill, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi, how are you doing today, Bill? I know that this is can be an emotional or difficult topic. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, basically, I was asked by my son to come and live with them while my grandson was growing up because they had him went to the doctor, and the doctor said basically he had autism. I had no idea of how to deal with that myself, but I said I would in fact come up and help.
Well, I'm sure that your family was emotionally or immensely grateful for you, and I think that your grandson probably is very lucky to have many adults in his life that are then helping the family and helping raise him.
You know, one of the things that I found about the experience of being with the young man was the fact that there were so many misnomers out there about the condition.
About autism?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it was very difficult for me to actually try to find help that was really, positive.
Now, in your family, was there a certain inclination to what caused your grandson's autism, or were you more focused on the fact that your grandson has this condition and how do we best help him? How do we find services that are adequate and meet his needs?
Right, that was my focus. my son and my daughter-in-law actually tried to track down a lineage within the families. We ourselves in our family, we didn't have any conditions like that or similar to that. But one of the things that I wanted to say was the school system here in Lacey was really excellent as far as of trying to provide for this young man and his schooling. The Horizon School, if I could, they had a support system that was such that I really, after being with the young man for 3 years, he consistently had the same teachers for the for 3 years in a row.
Well, I think that that's definitely wonderful. You're talking about Lacey, Washington, which is a suburb of Olympia. And I think that there's two different ways that a lot of parents and families can take the reality of having a child or you know, a family member with autism. And one is to look for a cause. And the other is to look for, you know, how to best care for this person and help them become the best person that they can. And I'm really glad that you and your family found some success with that in the school system.
Yeah, that's generally one of the two biggest complaints for parents is that one is that they feel like their children don't have enough resources. So it's really good to hear that they found something in Lakewood that you know helps their child. And the second one is a lot of parents worry about what's going to happen when I pass away. Who's going to take care of my child? Because many of these autistic children need a lot of care and a lot of supervision. So that's a good success story in terms of getting some sort of help for the child.
So, well, Bill, we thank you for your call. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
No, I just wanted to say thank you for the program. And, I really do appreciate having people, yourselves, you know, discuss this. Thank you so much.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill. And if you want to, like Bill, call in. Our number is 253-584-1480. We're accepting calls today until 4 o'clock. Case, it really sounded like here, Bill and his family were really focused on the here and now with this young man. What we're really addressing today also is people that either in addition to or instead of really try and attack a cause. It seems like maybe that is hearkening on what's more emotional or emotionally satisfying as opposed to pragmatically satisfying. You mentioned some of these anti-vaccination groups and some of the star power with Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy. Can you tell us a little bit about some of that star power and maybe some popular media some popular media coverage that may contribute to this?
Oh, sure. I think few people have more blood on their hands than Jenny McCarthy, with Andrew Wakefield, Jenny McCarthy, and Jim Carrey, at least those three. I the fact that they have been pushing their theories forward with no science whatsoever.
And these are theories in the literary sense of ideas, suggestions, hypotheses, claims.
Yes, yeah. So a little bit about Jenny McCarthy. She had stated that her child had autism. And much like many in the anti-vaxxer crowd, she said that her child was normal until it got vaccinated, and then it stopped making eye contact, stopped socializing, and started showing many cues of autism. So she became a spokesperson for Generation Rescue, and in 2008 they had a Green the Vaccine march in Washington D.C. And so if you ever Google Jenny McCarthy and vaccines, and you see picture of her and Jim Carrey with a green shirt on and a bullhorn, it's from that march on Washington, D.C.
And they were making the claim, of course, that they think that the preservative in the vaccines is the one causing autism.
Right, right. For a while, they blamed the mercury-based preservative thimerosal. So at the request of these parent groups, these ingredients were taken out of vaccines. And that was done, I think, in early 2000. And so the data that's come out of that is that there's no change in the rate of autism diagnoses that we've seen. None whatsoever.
But there has been a dramatic increase, as you were saying before our last break, between the 80s and between now. And now there's differences between whether there actually has been an increase in actual autistic individuals or whether there has been an increase in the accurate diagnosis of autistic individuals.
That's a great point. There are two things that lend themselves to greater numbers of autistic children. One of them, as you said, is better diagnoses, that parents are paying attention to paying attention to the various signs and symptoms. Also, there's been a change in the definition of what autism is. Autism is what's known as a spectrum disease, in that you could be at the low end of Asperger's and all the way up to very low functioning. So with the change of definition, that's widened the net in terms of how many kids are defined as autistic. So that's important to note as well, too. So one thing I also want to touch on was the causes, the potential causes of autism. So we've talked about how there's no science behind vaccinations. There has been some discussion about environmental factors as well. There was a study done that stated that women who lived within a quarter mile of a highway had a 50% chance of more likely having a child that was autistic. So obviously there's some controversy around that because freeways and highways have been around for, say, 50-plus years. So why would they be more likely to have autistic children?
And now, to be fair, is this a causal claim that's being stated, or is this merely something that's tracking a correlation where two things happen at the same time? We don't know whether one causes the other.
There also could be a socioeconomic factor in this too. I imagine that there aren't a lot of country clubs right next to the freeway,
yeah.
And that the people who say live near the freeway have a tendency to not have as much money as people who can afford to live away from them, and maybe that's the deciding factor there.
That's entirely possible.
The quality of medical care that somebody's able to get.
I have also read studies that indicate that children of color who are on Medicaid receive an autism diagnosis on average several months later than white children on private insurance. So maybe the date of diagnosis and the beginning of different kinds of therapies and intensive occupational therapies may have an effect on that as well.
That's entirely possible, yeah. Another factor that was cited was the age of the parents. Another study that was done stated that for every 10 years old that a mother is, the chances of her child having autism increase by 30%. So, and same thing with the father. For every 10 years old that the father is, every increment of 10 years, the rate goes up 20%. So we know that people are getting married later on in life, and we know that they're having children later on in life. This may have something to do with that.
And autism. And lastly, Bill from Olympia, our last caller, had talked about how they had looked back in their family and seen that there were no behaviors suggestive of autism in their family lineage. But there has been some discussion about a genetic component.
Yeah.
Has there not?
Yeah. What we do know is that identical twins have a 90% likelihood of both being autistic. So that seems to suggest that there's a genetic marker involved in autism.
And when we come back, we're going to take a break for a few moments. But when we come back, please do feel free to call us at 253-584-1480. We're going to continue talking about the link between vaccinations, or the purported link between vaccinations and the rise of autism. You're listening to Ask an Atheist. We're available on askanatheist.tv. We'll see you back in about 2 minutes.
If you're an atheist or atheist-friendly person and you'd like to join the Ask an Atheist crew after the show for conversation, beer, hot dogs, and brats, it's happening at 5 o'clock at the Red Hot.
The Red Hot specializes in craft beers and delicious hot dogs and brats.
On tap right now, Walking Man Homo Erectus Imperial IPA, Great Divide Titan IPA, Georgetown Lucille IPA, Sierra Nevada Pale, Alpine Pilsner, Anchor Porter, Stone Green Flash Port Brewing Highway 78 Scotch Ale, Walking Man Black Cherry Stout, Sound Brewing Beverager, New Belgium Littoral, Old Tacoma Lager, Schooner Extract 3 Grid IPA on cask, and North Coast Old Rasputin Russian Imperial Stout on Nitro.
Join us at the Red Hot, 2914 6th Avenue in Tacoma.
This is a 21 and over establishment.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an integral part of your business. But that's not all. We can set you up with VoIP, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to helping your business succeed through and with technology. At Tacoma Telematics, we are committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. We're taking calls until 4 o'clock at 253-584-1480. I'm Becky. With me today are Case and Mike. We're talking about the purported link between vaccination and autism at Ask an Atheist today. If you would like to call us, please do. If you would like to email us, please do at askanatheist.tv, where there's a big red button where you can click on it and ask a question.
You know, the irony of vaccinations is that they are the victim of their own success. The community recollection of these diseases has largely disappeared. We're pretty much a generation or two away from parents seeing how bad polio or whooping cough is firsthand.
Now, I think even myself and Mike were born after the era where children in the U.S. were regularly vaccinated for polio, because now we count on herd immunity. We count on the fact that there is no polio circulating in our population, and so neither Mike or I have been vaccinated.
Yeah, I think it's really important that I think people, when they hear things like measles, rubella, mumps, they think of these as these weird little odd childhood diseases.
Or third world things, yeah.
This is something that happens somewhere else, and I don't think they really understand the stakes of what this disease can do. I mean, you have a famous case of polio. I mean, we had a president who was in a wheelchair because of a childhood case of polio. But people forget that these things were fatal at one point, that these things killed people. They killed children. And I think that, like you said, that a vaccine has sort of become so successful that people forget how important and necessary it is.
Yeah. We haven't seen teenagers die of diphtheria, for example. I mean, that's completely been eradicated thanks to the success of vaccinations. Yeah.
Same with smallpox. And I know that in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, there were some smallpox scares where we started pulling up old photographs of individuals with smallpox. And I know that I was in my 20s and I had never seen what someone with smallpox actually looked like. I thought it was maybe a bad case of chickenpox. No, much worse, much scarier.
Yeah,
we forget that there was a time people died from these diseases. They died.
Yes.
Children died in horrible, horrible ways, and that even when people contract these diseases today, because of their immunizations, they're able to fight off these things much worse than an unvaccinated person.
There are actually some parents out there who think that these type of childhood diseases are almost a rite of passage, that you're supposed to get measles and you're supposed to get these other diseases as part of your childhood, and that's what makes you stronger as you grow up.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the mechanism behind inoculation. Literally, it is just entering a pathogen entering your body and your body developing some antibodies against it so that you don't develop the symptoms and the full-blown disease at a later time. That's the mechanism behind inoculation. It's the same mechanism behind having a chickenpox party. I had a chickenpox party when I was a little kid, where it was, because that was before the development of a chickenpox vaccine, where you wanted to develop that immunity. Either you develop it through an injection, or you develop it through ingestion or respiration of that particular live pathogen. I would much rather have my child develop antibodies to an attenuated virus or a dead virus than to have to go through the full-blown symptoms of having chickenpox for a week, having high fevers, et cetera, et cetera.
And I remember that I actually got chickenpox twice in my life. My sister and I both got it again when we were in junior high or high school, I believe early high school. And our neighbor Bill, who is an immigrant from Greece at the time, had not been immunized against chickenpox, and he could not come over. There was a fear that if he became exposed to it, he could potentially die. That we forget that these annoying little childhood illnesses, that, like you said, are a rite of passage, are potentially fatal to some people. We've really learned to underestimate.
Yeah, that's totally where the notion of anecdotal evidence comes in. Like, oh, I had measles, and I, some people say I survived, I did fine. And they don't forget. They forget about those who died, or they're not aware of those who died.
It's like the equivalent of being attacked by a dog that has a muzzle on. You're like, oh, that wasn't that bad. He pushed me around, and then you have a dog without a muzzle.
Yeah,
and suddenly it's like, wow, I could really die.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So
we do have some callers. On line one, we have a caller who is in favor of who believes in a correlation between vaccines and the development of autism. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, but are you with us? Caller in SeaTac.
Yeah, my name's Lee.
Hi, Lee.
Hello. I have a son that had an extreme reaction when he was inoculated at 2 months. And it did change, you know, let's face it, at 2 months, you know, their personality is obviously extremely developed. But the type of child he was changed. And, you know, to this day, he still has certain glitches that I don't know whether it involves a shot, but that are just kind of interesting, unlike a normal child. The other thing that I have...
I just want to stop you there real quick. Are you saying that your child has autism or some developmental...
No, it is not. Well, it's never been diagnosed as autism.
Okay.
He's been looked at, but there's just certain little brain glitches that are just interesting. It would take too long to go into on this program, but
in a nutshell, does he have problems in social situations or with schoolwork or something like that? In a nutshell,
more along the lines of say he wants something. Say he wanted randomly. He wants spaghetti.
Yeah.
Say he wants spaghetti. And he can start to get upset about it. You can set a bowl of spaghetti in front of him, and he would continue to be upset about not having spaghetti.
So it's almost like an impulse control kind of thing. Is that fair
correct.
To say? Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, there's a few other glitches. So I'm not. But the other thing that I've also worked with is animals, and I've worked with dogs that have gone through, like the puppy mill pups that come out of. They go into the pet stores. Well, most of those dogs are inoculated quickly. I mean, they're hit within 2 weeks with up to like 25 different vaccinations. If you meet a good percentage of the owners of these dogs, they have major immune system problems.
Yeah, but are you drawing the connection between the inoculation and the behavior, or is this a question of the puppy mill? It seems like there's a lot of other factors at work here than just the inoculation.
Well, there are multiple factors, but what I'm saying is there's also
What I'm asking is why draw the connection between the inoculation and the behavior when there are those other factors?
Additionally, it seems to me...
Because I'm talking about immune systems versus... I'm thinking it's an immune system issue. And I'm seeing that overwhelming any animal, person or animal, with a number of different vaccines at once. I'm not against vaccines. I'm just seeing that we inoculate. I think, personally, it seems to me that it's too many at once.
So one Obviously, of the things I'm that not... you're talking about, Lee, is actually the oft-talked about vaccine overload hypothesis, and
correct.
That's where it seems like, you know, having three inoculations for measles, mumps, and rubella in one vaccine in one day seems like it's a lot. And certainly as someone who's caring for, you know, either a small creature or a small child, we never like to see children in pain, and shots can induce pain. And so we think, oh, this must be something damaging, when in reality, children are exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, of pathogens daily through ingestion, that's eating, through respiration, that's breathing in, and through injury. You get scraped, you get bumped, and something enters your bloodstream right away. Some of those happen to be viruses. Some of those happen to be proteins on pollens. Some of those happen to be little bacterium in dirt. And we have children and human beings and animals that develop immunity to many, many pathogens daily. And the measles virus, the mumps virus and the German measles virus in one vaccination dose is just 3 out of the 100 that a child may be exposed to every day. So,
but you're not at 2 months of age. You're being injected into your blood system, and most 2-month olds aren't exposed to as much say, a child who goes to school, that sort of thing. I think the other issue is I think we start way too early with it.
And those are different kinds of issues that are being developed and researched pretty regularly. And there are different kinds of vaccine schedules that are around in different countries. But we do know that the development of herd immunity has been something that's immensely positive in preventing death and injury to children who were regularly contracting these really difficult childhood illnesses. But Lee, we do have a few callers, and we're close to the end of the hour, so I do thank you for your call. I do also just want to note that neurological development really does occur over many years after birth, and it can make some syndromes or some symptoms, that is, seem like they're caused by other things, whereas it may just be a random, neurological development. We have another caller on line two, I think Charles from Illinois. How are you, Charles?
So far, so good.
Hi, you wanted to tell us about different survival rates throughout history, and we're coming up on the end of our hour, so if you could be brief.
Succinct for us, yeah.
Okay. In 1900, the average survival length of life was 47 years. The survival rate for children reaching the age of 15 was like 1 in 4. The average survival rate of childbirth was like 1 in 5. The average survival of the women approximately the same time was like 3 out of 5.
And so that was around 1900. How about now, 100 years later?
The survival ratios now are significantly higher.
78 years is the average age now, 78 years.
Yes, the average age is 78 years. The average survival rate for children born in the United States making it to the age of 15, i.e. the start of reproductive times, is like close to 99 out of 100 or something like that.
There are definitely many advances in medical care and nutrition that have contributed to that.
Primary ones has been vaccination.
Absolutely. Yep. A really important part of increasing the survival rate.
Yeah, a lot of diseases that used to be fatal in childhood, we've conquered, polio being one of them.
It's considered one of the greatest triumphs of modern medicine, yeah.
Yes. Now, one of the best sources of information on this is the book, The Way We Never Were. It describes how we got the image of how wonderful and glorious things were in the past during the 1950s television series and so forth.
I love it. That's great. The Way We Never Were. I'm going to have to check that out. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Charles.
Yeah, we're getting close to the end, so
I apologize. We'll look up and maybe we can have some reports back through email on those who have read that book or be familiar with that.
Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, I'd like to say something about a call that we had earlier. The person who saw he made a lot of assertions and a lot of assumptions. One, that there was definitely some kind of immunology, something played into the connection between this and the behavior, but I never really saw that connection. However, there is a clear connection between things like measles, mumps, rubella, polio, smallpox, and these vaccines. That the example of that kid who was not vaccinated, they were too young to be vaccinated, people dying from measles, something that we don't think of as this death plague anymore.
Yeah. I want to just touch on his call real quickly, too, because he also, I feel like he had touched on that maybe some environmental factor or something else at play as well, or at least that's my interpretation of it. I just wanted to say to Lee that we've proven pretty systematically that there is no causal link between autism and vaccines. It just doesn't exist.
Repeated studies have failed to show any
very
kind
large
of link,
study.
Any
so,
kind of cause.
So it's so there may be some other environmental factor, something else that we just don't know yet. But it's irresponsible for people to say, I know what it is, and have no science to back it up. Because what we found, via folks like Jenny McCarthy and others, is that this lends itself to irresponsible behavior. So I just wanted to put that out there real quick regarding Lee's call.
Yeah, and at the same time, the methods that Andrew Wakefield used, the fact that the what did you call it, the over...
The vaccine overload hypothesis.
The vaccine overload hypothesis, that this had, this was something that he'd even abandoned himself, yet he still did not abandon the idea that vaccines had this clear, direct link to autism. And then he made it about the preservative. That was removed. It seems like he's just moving the goalposts here, that he has a conclusion that he likes, and when the evidence no longer supports his answer, he just finds a new one.
Right.
And it can be really difficult with someone like Lee and C-Tech, who is maybe, you know, dealing with a child who is doing unexpected things that we expect as a parent, our child to be, you know, wonderful and precious and all along the same developmental milestones, if not overachieving beyond those developmental milestones. And it can be very hard. And my heart goes out to parents who are struggling with child behaviors and illnesses and everything like that.
Yeah. If you're concerned, you should bring your child to a professional and have them evaluate it, maybe do some tests or ask some questions of your doctor and see if you can get a proper diagnosis if one exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Mike and Case, we are coming up towards the end of the hour. For all of our listeners, we want to invite you to, again, come to the Red Hot in Tacoma on 6th Ave. Today, I'm Becky Friedman, and with me were Case and Mike Gillis, our digital director and call screener, or Sam, were both fulfilled by Sam Mulvey. And our production assistant today was Megan King. Ask an Atheist is a production of NEDM Media. We'd love to see you and your feedback at askanatheist.tv.
Thanks for listening.
Keeping you informed, this is KLAY, Lakewood, Tacoma. Your conversations.